Chapter 3, Lakewood and Athens, Ohio, 1973 to 1976. After the Air Force discharged me in San Francisco, I hitchhiked my way home to Lakewood, Ohio. Aside from being slowed down a bit by my poor sense of direction, it was a very uneventful journey. So uneventful, I can barely remember it. It was late September 1973. After 4 years in the service, I decided that maybe college would not be such a bad idea after all. I had the GI Bill coming to me, 4 years of relative maturity under my belt, and a pretty good idea of what I wanted to major in, photography. It was too late to register for fall classes at Ohio University. I had to wait a year. Since I needed to work between then and when school started, I looked up a friend from high school, Louis Nolan, who owned and operated an in-town delivery service. I reasoned that, with all his delivery customers, he might know someone out there looking for employees. He did. It was a pretty unlikely job, but I wasn't picky. There's a company on East 55th Street called Rolled Alloys, he told me. They're looking for a few good men. With any luck, I was going to be a steel worker. At the time, my car was a 1965 Mercury, a.k.a. Turnpike Cruiser. It was a gas hog cabin cruiser of a car. Unfortunately, the windshield wipers didn't work, and it was going to cost $300 to fix them. I bought the car for $500, so logic dictated I couldn't justify spending another $300 on the wipers. If the weather forecast predicted rain or snow, I used public transportation, which really sucked. To get to Rolled Alloys by 8 a.m., I had to wake up at 5 a.m., take the Detroit Avenue bus to the Rapid Transit Station, take the Rapid to downtown Cleveland, transfer it to another eastbound Rapid to get to East 49th Street, and walk 6 blocks. Two notable things happened during these treks to work. One was finding a $5 bill on the sidewalk a block from the plant. The other event wasn't fun at all, just another item for the strange and stupid category. To get to the bus stop on Detroit Avenue, I had to walk down Waterbury Avenue around 5:30 each morning. Naturally, it was still dark at that hour, and, of course, very quiet. Halfway down the street, lost in early morning thoughts and still not quite awake, I felt something grab the back of my ankle. The whole incident, start to finish, took 4 seconds, but seemed much longer. In those 4 seconds, I jumped up, grabbed my ankle, probably screamed, hopped around on one leg, and had instant thoughts about a rabid squirrel sucking my life's blood out while injecting me with the deadly rabies virus. Would I have to get rabies shots in my stomach? Would they hurt so badly I would start sobbing in front of a hot-looking nurse? Actually, what happened was that a small plastic Ace pocket comb had slipped through a hole in my back pocket and gotten wedged between my ankle and the back of my shoe. After composing myself, I looked around to see if anyone had noticed this spastic display. I don't think anyone had. I combed my hair, put the comb back in my other pocket, and headed toward the bus stop. Rolled Alloys was, and maybe still is, a specialty steel company. Its main product was steel plate and bar steel, which were cut to specifications for the manufacture of furnaces. My job was to stack huge steel plates, 1/8 of an inch to 1 inch thick, on edge, then lean them against support columns. These plates ranged from 4 by 8 feet wide to 10 by 20 feet wide and were moved by a ceiling crane. Long steel cables ended in a huge metal clamp. My job was to hook the clamp onto the exact center of the plate. Once I had the clamp centered and closed, all I had to do was hit the button to raise the steel plate. When it was off the ground, I used the control buttons to line it up with the other plates and slowly set it down. Then I went back for the next one. We employed the same steps for the bar steel that came in. It wasn't a bad job, although it was probably pretty dangerous. Fortunately, I was never injured. I was fairly impressed with the equipment we used for cutting the steel, like the computerized large plasma flatbed steel cutting machine. It was fun to watch. Whatever form we fed into the computer, this machine would cut it to scale. Neat. One amazing and incredibly inexplicable situation was the fact that my brother David worked there for a little while. I understood the desperation of needing a job. But David was, and still is, a very talented organist, pianist, and harpsichordist. Although at the time he could not have been more than 21, it was clear to everyone that he was going to make music, specifically keyboard music, his life's work. One slip of anything, and he would have had to follow my goofy steps, which I don't recommend to gifted musicians. Thankfully, his short time there was without incident. To this day, he still makes his living through music. Dan, one of the guys I worked with at Rolled Alloys, was black. I normally wouldn't mention race, except that it's an important part of the story. During our brief employment together, I brought up my interest in photography. I'm sure I told him about some of my experiences in the Air Force. I may have left out the helicopter fiasco. I told him that after I came back home from the service, my mother let me convert one of her spare bedrooms into a darkroom, and I did quite a bit of shooting and processing in my free time. One day he told me that he and his wife were going to renew their marriage vows. He asked if I would photograph the ceremony. He said he didn't have much money and figured that having a darkroom at home, I might be able to cut him a break if I shot it all in black and white. He was also under the impression that I knew what I was doing. I figured this would be a good learning experience for me, so I agreed to do the shoot and processing for free, as long as he paid for the materials. The cost of film, paper, chemicals, etc. could not have totaled more than $10. Up to this point, aside from my Air Force experience, most of my shooting consisted of forest, trees, and nature scenes. Or, as my brother Paul once said about my subject matter, "Yeah, these shots are great, Jimmy. Looks like you've documented just about every tree in the valley." I had a flash but used it sparingly. In short, I wasn't 100% sure about what I was doing as a flash or wedding photographer. The blessed day arrived. It was raining. All the pictures had to be taken indoors. This meant I had to use the flash. The ceremony took place in the small church on the east side of Cleveland. The reception that followed this recommitment to love took place in the happily, newly remarried couple's apartment, also on the east side. It was a short ceremony. I shot 24 exposures. Of course, I figured they were all great. At the reception, I was the only white guy in a room full of family and friends. I think Dan asked me to come to the reception because he thought it was the right thing to do. I didn't feel unwelcome. I just felt uncomfortable. At one point, Dan grabbed me and three or four of his buddies, and we headed to the bedroom to smoke a joint and drink a few cold 45s. A joint and a beer would normally make me feel much better. It didn't. After what I thought was an appropriate amount of time to stick around, I thanked them all and headed for home. I processed the film the next day. If you know anything about darkroom film processing, you know that as soon as the lights come on and you look at your negatives, you know whether or not the images have been properly exposed. I looked. These weren't. I was screwed. My stomach did a little flip. I broke into a cold sweat, reminiscent of the helicopter incident. I had either set the flash or the camera incorrectly, and the film was grossly underexposed. In fact, only the faintest images appeared on the film. I thought I might be able to salvage one shot, the one shot where the happy couple walked up the aisle, hand in hand for the first time, as the new Mr. and Mrs. Dan. Although I was fairly adept in the darkroom, my best efforts only managed to produce a print that resembled the smiling teeth, two sets, of the Cheshire Cat and the tree in Alice in Wonderland. And that was it. Two sets of eyeballs, two sets of smiles, one set understandably lower than the other. That was Mrs. Dan. I never showed Dan that picture. I apologized the next time I saw him at work. I told him that I was really sorry and very upset with myself, but that something had been terribly wrong with that piece of crap flash and none of the pictures had come out. He said, "Ain't no big thing, brother." Half the people there had cameras, and he was sure it was well documented. While finishing up my career at Rolled Alloys as a steel-stacking, precision-cutting fool, I applied to attend Ohio University for the summer semester. That was June 1974. Ohio U was an obvious choice for many reasons. It was close to home, but far enough away that I couldn't go home every weekend. As a state school, it was more lenient about my less-than-stellar grades from high school. My brother Roberts and Paul both graduated from there. The school had a great reputation for its photography department, and last but not least, it was rated one of the best party schools in the nation. Because I had spent 4 years in the Air Force, I didn't have to live in a dorm, the normal requirement for incoming freshmen. I lived in a 5-bedroom house 3 blocks from campus. The parents of two of the guys living there, Dan and Dave, bought the place so their kids would have somewhere to live while going to school. At the same time, Dan and Dave served as live-in landlords. Some parents were very smart. The house was roomy enough, and none of us were slobs. It had a foosball table on the front porch. I'm still very good at foosball. And the landlords were great. I believe Dave was the older of the two. They reminded me of the Smothers brothers, Dave being the smart one. Dan was not stupid, he was just goofier. Here are two stories from Dave illustrating Goofy Dan. One evening, Dan took some kind of hallucinogen, mushrooms, orange sunshine, something. Later that night, still really high from the drug, Dan was with some friends in one of the numerous taverns in town drinking a few beers. He had to go to the bathroom. The interior of this particular bathroom and the door were covered with walnut paneling. After Dan took a whiz, still high and disoriented, the seamless paneling made it impossible for Dan to find his way out. In short, he got lost in the bathroom. Panicked, he started banging on the walls. Of course, someone came to the rescue, allowing Dan to escape. In the end, it was a short, scary, drug-induced moment for Dan, and incredibly funny for anyone who knew what happened. Then there was a time that Dan bet Dave and a few of his friends, $10 each, that he could drink a 2-ounce bottle of Tabasco sauce and keep it down for 5 minutes. I wish I could have been there to see this. Dan took the bottle of Tabasco, poured the contents into a juice glass, and then, without hesitating, knocked it back like a shot of whiskey. Total silence. Everyone waited and waited. 10, 20, 30 seconds, 1 minute. Dan's chest started to heave. He choked, and then he coughed up most of it, through his nose. Dan said it took more than 2 weeks for the pain to subside completely. Although I was going to get the GI Bill to help pay for college, I still needed the disposable income. I needed a job. After I got settled into the house and started my required freshman classes, which included basic photo 101, I started job hunting. I didn't need much, maybe 20 or 30 hours a week. I answered an ad for a dishwasher at the downstairs restaurant. It was an Italian restaurant, or, as some say in southern Ohio, Italian, specializing in pizza. Walking down the stairs from the street level confirmed why it was called the downstairs restaurant. The interview for the dishwasher position was short. I was hired right after the mirror test. The owners of the place were Big Jim and his wife Peggy. Big Jim was quite a sight, or more like a building sight, now that I think about it. He weighed 438 pounds and stood more than 6 feet tall. He reminded me of a really large John Candy, only larger. And like John Candy, he probably did not live into his old age. One day, the gossip around the kitchen concerned Big Jim's visit to his doctor. Supposedly, Big Jim was told that the exertion and excitement, his only besides eating, of making love to his wife could give him a heart attack and possibly kill him. He had a choice, lose weight or curb the sex. I worked there for a year and never saw him back away from the table. He was alive when I quit. Either he had made the choice to keep eating and quit making love to his wife, or he was the one who had started the rumor in an effort to give us all the impression that he could do both and not die. By comparison, Peggy was much smaller, a mere 5 feet and 160 pounds. If my math is correct, that would have made her 65% lighter than he was. When we combined the doctor's advice, gossip, with our fertile young male imaginations, all sorts of images came to mind. Humorous, death-defying, squeamish, but none of them pleasant. Big Jim's main function were to run the restaurant and perform quality control over the menu items through continuous testing by ingestion method. Peggy managed the waitresses. It didn't take long for Big Jim to recognize that my talents were being wasted as a dishwasher. I was soon promoted to sous chef, or as we referred to it at the downstairs, the other cook. The main cook, Tom, who was working his way through school, looked like a young pizza maker from New York City. He was medium height, muscular, with black curly hair and a mustache. He was in his third year of something like engineering or philosophy. He impressed me as being very smart. We shared the same cynical outlook on life and the same deep affection for pizza. How could we not get along and have a lot of fun working together? Tom invited me over to his dorm one night for dinner, to be followed by going to the OU basketball game to watch the home team get its ass kicked. Tom lived in the married dorms with his wife. The married dorms were like efficiency apartments. Tom's wife, Cindy, was attractive and gracious, and seemed a perfect match for Tom. I was jealous. After settling in and drinking a couple of beers, Tom asked me if I'd like a sober, a powerful muscle relaxant with a strong soporific effect, hence the nickname, sober. Sopers were really popular in the early 70s. Despite the experience I'm going to relate, I still like muscle relaxants. If drugs were ever legalized, my choice would be codeine. Since I had never heard of sopers and was naturally curious about so many things, I said, sure. After gulping it down with a slug of bud, I asked Tom about the soper's effects and rapidity of onset. He told me not to worry about it, just to let him know when it hit. Keep in mind that I was still young and indestructible. We had some massive sub sandwiches for dinner and then drove over to the game. 10 minutes after we got to our seats and into the frenzied excitement of an OU basketball game, I told Tom that I didn't feel anything yet. I wondered when or if the soper would kick in. Tom's drug-taking philosophy was, when in doubt, have another. I did. Big mistake. No doubt the reason the first one hadn't taken effect as quickly as I expected was the sludge, composed of the 3/4-pound sandwich and beers I had for dinner, that it had to swim through before it could reach my bloodstream. Everything, including the game, soon became a blur. The ride home was harrowing. I felt like a 300-pound tub of goo. Tom thought it would be fun to take the long way home through some of the winding and pitch-dark rolling hills of southern Ohio, occasionally turning off his headlights. That Tom, what a joker. We arrived unscathed at the dorm, staggered in, sat down, and started scavenging around the kitchen for something to eat. Apparently, sopers are not appetite suppressants. At some point, I decided it was time to walk home. Tom was too loaded to drive me. If you've ever been drunk, you probably know how difficult it can be to walk a straight line. I was having the same trouble walking home, multiplied by 2 sopers. I also had trouble staying on the sidewalk on one side of the street. I'd start to list to the right and had to start running to catch up with myself to keep from falling. By the time I reached some semblance of balance, I was on the other side of the street. Then the odd street shuffle started all over again. This marathon dance ended when I fell before I got to the other side of the street and rammed my forehead into the bumper of a parked car. The next thing I knew, I woke up in my bed with a large knot on my forehead. Tom and I had a great laugh about this the next time we were slinging pizzas at the downstairs. As college jobs go, this was a good one. I ate a lot of pizzas, drank a lot of free beer supplied by our lovely waitresses, and had a lot of fun working with Tom. We continued to be amazed by Big Jim's appetite. I hummed along in my photography class and all the other required classes. Unfortunately, for my first semester photography class, I received a B for my portfolio, which also became my class grade. Unless you received an A, you are not eligible to advance to the intermediate level. My only option was to take the basic course over until I received an A. I was disheartened, but on the basis of my professor's subjective assessment of my work, I decided to continue with the degree requirements and think about taking the basic course later. Near the end of the regular school year, while out tooling around on my motorcycle, I lost control and sandwiched my leg between my bike and the pavement, snapping it in two. My leg, not the bike. I stayed in college through the summer, hobbling around with crutches and a cast that went halfway up my thigh. Not that this slowed me down much. One night at a party, after a few beers, I had to go to the bathroom. I was on the second floor of the party house. I managed, with my crutches, to get upstairs, find the john, take care of business, and start back down. After the first couple of steps, I thought I would be able to navigate the descent more easily without my crutches. I tossed them over the side of the railing, missing everyone. Then I grabbed a hold of the banister with both hands and started hopping down the stairs, one at a time, on my right leg. Unfortunately, I built up too much speed on the way down. Six steps from the landing, I had to firmly grip the banister with both hands to stop my momentum. It stopped my momentum all right and sent me head over heels crashing to the floor. Oddly enough, I was unscathed and unfazed. What's the saying? God protects fools and drunks. I had double coverage that night. As would happen many more times in my life, by the end of the summer, I had decided it was time to move on. I figured I was way too smart for school. Obviously, I was wise beyond my years. I wished I had stuck around. This was the second time I was to say this while looking back on my life. The first time was with the Air Force. I should have made a career of that. Of course, I was too young to know what lay ahead, and I was way too eager to find out. I thought at the time that the Air Force would slow me down and blunt my life experiences. But today, when I find myself in difficult or stressful periods, I dream of still being in the responsibly easy Air Force. And now, Ohio U. I should have stayed, repeated the photography class, and gotten my degree. I had no reason to leave except that I felt an indefinable restlessness. By the time I left OU and arrived at my mother's doorstep, the cast was off my leg. Although the limb was still weak, I managed to get around. This time, though, finding a job took a bit longer than I expected. With this new, unfamiliar difficulty of finding decent work, and given the jobs I subsequently found, it should have dawned on me to go back to school. I could have. I was still eligible for the GI Bill. I could easily have registered for fall classes at OU. It never entered my mind. Perhaps I was hardwired to burn the occasional bridge just for the excitement of an unknown and insecure future. I was hired to be a houseman at the Cleveland Marriott Inn on West 150th Street and I-71, and was told to report to work after I successfully breathed on the mirror. Even after the interview, I had no idea what a houseman was. This would not be the first job I got where I became qualified simply by walking through the door. Apparently, this was a position that required no explanation, preparation, or training. The minimum wage salary should have given me a clue that I was at the bottom of the hotel ladder. I was 27 and nursing a healing broken leg. I didn't have to pay rent at my mother's house. Maybe I thought that an easy, mindless gig was what I needed while fomenting grander plans. The job duties at the Marriott Inn for the houseman position were to prepare all the meeting rooms and ballrooms by bringing in the prescribed number of chairs, tables, podiums, and movable dance floors, etc., and setting them up according to the client's specifications. Duties also including tearing it all down at the end of each event. I knew this was a shitty job the moment I started working. Then, to make matters worse, I ran into a guy from my class at Lakewood High School. He was a concierge. He stood behind the check-in desk wearing what looked like a $200 suit, $1977. He looked prosperous and appeared to be an important and outstanding credit to the hotel industry. He could have pulled me aside and said, "Tidy, long time no see. Hey, this houseman thing is a dead end. If you want to work your way to up to desk clerk or something like that, let me know, bro, and I'll see what I can do. He didn't. On the third day there, I walked past one of the ballrooms. All I heard coming from it was the faint sound of music, a deep rhythmic beat, and very little else. I opened the doors to check it out. There were hundreds of well-dressed, incredibly quiet couples dancing to a floor-thumping beat. It didn't dawn on me what was going on until I looked at a few of the non-dancing people who were signing each other. Apparently, it was an event for the hearing impaired. Obviously strange to me, but not to them. The physical rigors of the job, my mending left leg, boredom, and very conscious feelings of inadequacy and embarrassment prompted me to move on after 2 weeks. Have you ever heard that if you drive a cab for a living, you will run into some very interesting people? I guess you'd have to drive a cab longer than I did to have a chance of testing that statement. I applied for and got a job as a Westlake cab driver. Like my brother John, when Mr. Mace from Chicken Galore asked him, "Do you know your way around town, son?" I replied, "Hey, I've lived here all my life. How could I not know my way around?" My career as a cabbie did not last long enough for me to have many passengers, and most of our conversations consisted of finding out where they wanted to go and their directions for getting there. I only had one passenger that you might put in the interesting column. He was so drunk when I picked him up from the Lakewood Village Tavern that he couldn't give me any useful directions. This was a classic case of the blind leading the blind or the drunk leading the ignorant. Although it was a long ride, it had a successful outcome. I realized that cab driving wasn't for me. I saw an ad in the paper that read, "Are you ready for the big time? $50,000 potential. No experience necessary. Extensive travel. Will train the right individual." I may have suspected it was sales, but I had to check it out anyway. When you can sell anything. And when you can't, it still doesn't make any difference what the product is. Too many people assume when they talk to me that I'd be a great salesman. Perhaps it has to do with the fact that I sound intelligent, can pour on the charm like turning on a faucet, and can be a very attentive listener. And very important, I have seemingly endless repertoire of jokes. If that's all it took to be a great salesman, then probably, well, who knows what the hell I would be doing. Jim Juthas was a sales manager working for Cardinal Publishing, a marketing company from California. The function of Cardinal Publishing was to produce and market a Chamber of Commerce directory and buyer's guide for individual Chamber of Commerce entities throughout the country. The finished product contained a list of all chamber members. The advertising sold to these members paid for the production of the directory, Jim's salary, and the salary of anyone else Jim talked into working for him. Despite my telling Jim during my interview that I couldn't sell a banana to a monkey, he still took me under his wing. If Sam could make it so, I would have been a huge success with Cardinal Publishing. Because I was living rent-free at home, I wasn't worried about earning large commissions, although I still had to buy gas, clothes, and beer. The pitch for selling the ads was that Chamber of Commerce members should network among themselves, thus help one another grow their businesses and grow the influence of the Chamber of Commerce. What's the best way to do this? As a chamber member, don't purchase any product or service until you've checked your directory. Buy from your fellow chamber members. They'll buy from you. Any idiot knows that this does not make much sense. Because I'm not an idiot, it was more than difficult for me to generate any enthusiasm in my sales pitch. Miraculously, I averaged $70 to $100 a week in commissions. The three-month sales period for Cardinal Publishing in Cleveland was coming to an end. While I were getting ready to move to the next city, I was perusing the classified ads for another opportunity in Cleveland. Jim was shocked. He tried to convince me that for a new guy, I did very well and that my potential was more than promising. He'd say things like, "Jim, don't you think you'd enjoy driving a new car, dressing like a stud, and dating women who will recognize what a success you are?" "Hell yes. Then damn it, you gotta come to the next city with me to give yourself the chance you deserve." I knew he was full of shit, but I liked him, and I didn't have anything else going on. The next city was Kansas City, Missouri. Cardinal Publishing was paying my way to drive out there and would put me up in a hotel for the duration of the company's stay.